This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang, at Gordon G. Chang, is my colleague and co-host, and we're very pleased to be joined by Professor Jim Holmes of the U.S. Navy War College, commenting on Chester Nimitz, the man who, at Honolulu and later at Guam, commanded the U.S. success in the Pacific in the Second War. Lessons learned from a new book, Craig Simons, Emeritus Professor of History at the Naval Academy. Jim, a very good evening to you. Craig Simons' book is a joy. We're going to take one lesson to lead with, which is the size of the Navy that Chester Nimitz inherited when he arrived in Pearl Harbor at the end of December following the catastrophe of the Japanese attack, and the size of the U.S. Navy he had when in Tokyo Harbor the end of the war was signed by dignitaries from the government, then government of Japan. What do we learn from that fleet in 41 to that fleet in 45? Good evening to you, Jim.
Hey, John. Hey, Gordon. Always a pleasure to be with you. Yeah, it's a wonderful book, as you said. A joy, I guess, is probably as good an adjective for it as any other. And I would certainly recommend it to anybody who's interested in World War II or the Navy or both. The big lesson I would draw, and I think Craig, and by the way, Craig came to us after Annapolis and was in my department for a while, so I will call him by his first name, even though he's not here. Craig is a wonderful storyteller, but the theme that he brings out repeatedly in the book, and it's one that we make a big deal out of in our seminars here as well, is this idea of a principle of calculated risk. This is what Nimitz calls it in his instructions to the fleet on the eve of the Battle of Midway in 1942. And by that, he basically just gives a very straightforward definition of this. Go out. He's under very lean resources after Pearl Harbor. All he's got is the beaten up remnants of that fleet. But he tells Admiral Fletcher and also Admiral Spruance, go out. If you think you can do worse to the Japanese than they can do to you, go for it. Otherwise, refrain from a major engagement in which you might lose the fleet. And this is a recurring theme that goes on throughout the war. Craig returns to this. Admiral Nimitz returns to it on the eves of major engagements. The one point I would make about calculated risk is that in 1943, I mean, Nimitz can actually afford to take more risk than he might otherwise in 1941 and 1942, simply because he knows that there's a newer, bigger, better U.S. Navy building in American shipyards, which was started in 1940. We were building up the Navy for World War II long before we joined the war. He knew that fleet was going to start showing up in the theater in 1943, and therefore he could afford to risk the Pearl Harbor fleet, the remains of the Pearl Harbor fleet, because he knew he had a spare coming. You can risk a lot more if you have a spare of something than if you don't. And I think that's a lesson for today, because we don't have a spare coming. And I actually wonder whether we could afford to start accepting a lot of risks in a fight with China or Russia, simply because the Navy we have right now is the one that we're going to go to war with. And if we were to lose a lot of that, it's not going to be easily replaced.
Gordon, you have a question for our friend.
Jim, you talk about Nimitz knowing that there's going to be a bigger fleet. At least from lay perspective, it appears the Navy can't build ships anymore. They've had problems, of course, with their littoral combat ships. We have seen delays with the Ford, the supercarrier, and there have been problems with the Zumwalt-class destroyer. I could go on and on. But the question is, why can't the Navy produce ships at a fast clip, or at least ships that the Navy believes are ready for combat?
Yeah, it's a big topic, and I would reach back about 20 years to the early days of the first Bush administration. And the Pentagon and the Navy had this agenda they called the transformation agenda, in which in essence, if you apply this to shipbuilding, they essentially said, well, we have all these neat sort of gee-whiz technologies coming down the pike. Why don't we design a hull and pile a bunch of them onto that hull and come up with this really wonderful ship. And it's a wonderful idea, but the fact is that we just started ordering these things into mass production long before we knew that whether the associated technologies were going to work, and some of them did not. For example, you mentioned the littoral combat ship. The Navy just this year has basically canceled a bunch of those, simply because we couldn't make the anti-submarine warfare package that was supposed to go onto them work. So, I mean, to go back to Nimitz and risk, you're talking about technological risk, and we took big technological risks, and some of them didn't pay off, and therefore, we're now living with the results. I will say that I think the good news on the Zumwalt and the Ford is the Ford seems to have most of the kinks worked out now at last. The Zumwalt actually seemed to be a pretty good platform, but they were just so expensive that we couldn't afford that. We were going to get 32 of them, and we ended up with three because they were so darn expensive. We can't afford the ammunition for them to use their guns, so we're talking about reconfiguring them to carry hypersonic missiles and so forth. But we're actually living with a hangover from the turn of the century.
Nimitz was a submariner. He thought about submarines chiefly as an offensive weapon. Now, that is said to be a strength of the U.S. Navy. Does that answer, have we got a submarine fleet that can grow? Because my understanding from many conversations with you is the PLA Navy is weak on anti-submarine warfare.
Yeah, I think this is an enduring advantage for the United States, for the U.S. Navy, is in undersea warfare. And my guess is, I mean, you would have to talk to people who do work in the classified realm to get a really good lock on how good the PLA Navy is at improving its anti-submarine capabilities. But I think we're probably still way ahead on that. The main thing I worry about with the submarine fleet today is just we don't have that many boats. If you look at the volume of water we're trying to patrol with a fleet that's stagnant or even in decline. In raw numbers, at the same time we're trying to build a whole new class of ballistic missile submarines. I mean, this is putting a massive strain on the submarine defense industrial base. So on a one-for-one basis, I remain very confident, but the fact is that we just don't have enough mass to really suit me and to suit the Navy. We are trying to build up towards a fleet of 66 attack submarines, as the Chief of Naval Operations made clear in his new plan for the Navy that was released just yesterday. So if we can make that go, I would feel a lot more comfortable with the situation.
And is the submarine fleet at this point large enough to take risks, going back to your point?
Yeah, my answer would be that our margin for accepting risk is pretty low. I guess sort of on the flip side, the more elusive our subs are, the more the harder they are to find. That tends to damp down the risk. But yeah, so losing one, I mean, if I lose one out of a fleet of 50 or two out of a fleet of 50, that's actually a significant blow, especially given that we know that about a third of those will be in maintenance at any time. I mean, you're talking about a pretty small force. So if you lose a large percentage of your combat power by losing one hull, that's a big deal. So. There's definitely major trade-offs in submarine warfare.
Gordon, we have a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
Jim, I get the sense that China is turning out ships very fast, but those ships may not be as capable. Our Navy has the philosophy of turning out, as you point out, ships that will be extremely capable. What do you think of China's strategy in terms of mass production of hulls?
You know, I've actually been, well, I mean, first of all, just a disclaimer, a weapon system, especially a foreign weapon system, is a black box in peacetime. I can look at the outside, I can count them up, I can see what they seem to be able to do and so forth, but there's also a lot of inferring. I have to infer what's inside, how capable it is, how capable the users are, and so forth. So, I mean, reaching back to 20 years when I started doing China work, I've been very impressed with how they would build a few of each platform, guided missile destroyers, for example. Take them out to sea, see which design was the best, try to kludge them into a really good design, and then go into mass production. So I think that's the correct approach. But the real question is, have they staged a leap to technological parity or superiority over ourselves? My guess is the answer is no. But again, that's just my guess, and you'd have to talk to people who do tactics and weaponry and so forth in the classified world every day to get a really solid handle on that. But my guess is that it's really hard to do that, and they have not managed it. They have done very impressive things, however.
Professor, in Craig Simons's book, Nimitz at War, there is a foil, Ernest King, the Comanche, a commander of all the fleets, Atlantic and Pacific. And King's opinion early on in the conflict is get out there and punch somebody. Now, he was a risk taker, and Nimitz then endorsed it at Midway, as you've said. But do we have that in the Navy at the flag rank now? Get out there and punch somebody when the Chinese misbehave in the Taiwan Strait. Do we have somebody give the order, punch them?
You know, that's a good question. It's kind of a bad parallel to draw. Since the Defense Department did not exist back in World War II, Admiral King, he was the commander in chief of the American fleet. I mean, he was the operational commander of the United States Navy, as well as the administrative commander, as much as our chief of naval operations is today. It wouldn't be Admiral Gilday or the chief of naval operations telling anybody to punch anybody. It would be potentially Admiral Aquilino, who's in charge of the U.S. Pacific or Indo-Pacific Command now, who would actually give that order. My impression of Admiral Aquilino is he would have some king-like tendencies if we ever get in the scrap with China. I bet him just a couple of times, and he impresses me as that kind of guy. But I mean, Nimitz oftentimes tried to hold back King. He thought King was accepting too much calculated risk with very very scarce assets, which is why Nimitz went from rather cautious and prudent in 1942 to much more risk accepted from 1943 on.
Professor Jim Holmes of the U.S. Naval War College, Gordon Chang at Gordon G. Chang, Chester Nimitz of the U.S. Navy. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.